Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:01 PM, the Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 25th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, there's I think it's palpable fear evident in consumers. And the more people I talk to and the more I walk around and see, then I can see increasing evidence of people that are deeply psychologically affected by the lockdowns and by the fear of the coronavirus. In just the last few days alone, I've seen a number of people almost have a breakdown at the thought of being in a room or close to even more than three or four people. The number of queues that I've had to stand in where people have berated each other for standing too close or for not wearing their mask correctly or any of these sorts of things have also increased a lot in the last couple of weeks. But I think it's very important to highlight some important facts, because what we are now in a position is that politics has completely taken over the medical field, and this is a dangerous phenomenon. It's certainly not something that we've really been accustomed to, that a reaction in terms of the medical establishment would have any bearing on politics. But now it's politicians are having an effect on how medical decisions are being made, to the extent that I received an email from my daughter's new high school just yesterday saying that they'd been in a meeting with the head of public health in Los Angeles County, who said that there was no way they were going to open the schools again until after the election. What on earth the presidential election has to do with the number of cases is completely beyond my comprehension, but that's beside the point, because what we have definitely seen is that politics has taken over the perception of the size and magnitude of the problem. So let's look at some charts, because we can see, for example, in the UK that there were some big announcements made in here this week about the extent to which the government is willing to support the furloughs, and they are pulling back from that. They're still providing additional assistance, but it's not going to be to the same extent as what was done previously. So at least on one regard, that should be positive from the perspective of the currency. Perhaps not great for the economy in the short term, but of course then it's all going to come down to the question of just how bad is the coronavirus infection rate. Well, the number of new cases is rising exponentially. So when people focus on that, and it is by far the most reported of all figures, then it's something that really does weigh on sentiment. And I think that that's certainly something that's important. But we should also look at the number of deaths. And unfortunately, that has now failed. So let's look at the number of deaths here. And it bottomed in August. Now, it has ticked up again over the course of the last couple of weeks, but nothing compared to the kind of acceleration that we had in March. So there is obviously something else going on here. Well, when we look at the number of tests being performed, well, back in April it was pretty risible. Now it's up to 375,000 tests a day. Well, logic would stand that the more tests you do, the more cases you'll find. That's obvious. So it's important then to just divide one by the other. And then when we look at that, well, we can see, for example, that this is a color-coded map. And the countries with the least incidences of cases relative to number of tests performed are places like Australia and New Zealand, which very successfully managed their infections. But we've also got places like Thailand or Finland. Then we also have just in the next area, which is somewhere between less than 1 and below 2%, you've got the UK, which means that for every 375,000 tests being performed, about 1 to 2% of people are in fact infected. Well, obviously, that is a much wider net than was being thrown back in March. So, obviously, you are finding a lot more cases. But then, of course, we have to have, if we're going to look at a chart, if we're going to look at any kind of historical comparison, well, we have to then consider that the number of tests being performed is a very significant variable. It's not a constant. This is the greatest problem that we have with making any kind of determination about the coronavirus based upon all of the information that's been provided, because the basis for any kind of scientific conclusion is that you have to have a controlled environment. Then you also have to be able to identify what your variables are. And then you have to also identify what your constants are. And what the constant is in this environment is very difficult to define. So then when we look at some of these other charts, well, what about the number of deaths? And if we then look at historical data, well, we can see, for example, that every year after Christmas, there's a spike in deaths. And that's a well-recognized phenomenon. And until approximately March of this year, 2020 was not all that different. Then we had a significant spike in deaths, and subsequently it has come straight back down. So the peak in infections and deaths has already passed. We can do more testing and we'll find more people that are infected, but that doesn't necessarily map over onto an exponential rate of increase in the number of dangerous infections. Then when we this is obviously a revolutionary concept. Maybe we should go and talk to doctors who are right there in the hospitals and treating people on a regular basis. And then we find out that the mortality rate is extraordinarily high in people over the age of 80, but it is not even close to 100%. It's not even 50%, or it's not even 20%. So yes, it does kill more people that are aged than the flu, for example, but it's certainly not a death sentence for the entire demographic. Then when we look at younger people, there has been an awful lot of commentary about the spread of the virus among college-going kids as they head back to campuses, but there has been one death in the USA and thousands of cases, and the vast majority of people didn't even know they had it. So we are now at a position where we know a lot more about the virus, and we know that it's not the kind of killer that was initially feared. The original lockdown was supposed to be for 2 weeks, and it's been more than 6 months. One of the fears expressed at the beginning was that once a lockdown is introduced, it's very hard to unwind. So what is it that's going to be required to unwind these lockdowns? Because we are no longer basing decisions upon the science, and we're no longer listening to doctors. So paying any attention at all to those statistics is irrelevant. Instead, we need to listen to what politicians are saying. And they are clearly saying that in order to lift the lockdowns, we need to have a vaccine. So therefore, the big question is, when are we going to have a vaccine? And what are the conditions that need to be met in order for a vaccine to be approved? Well, the Nasdaq Biotech Index firmed today from the region of the trend mean, and it has first step above the base characteristics in much the same way that it consolidated above the range all the way back in 2013. That range had been very lengthy and followed the collapse from the peak in 2000. Well, then we had a really impressive advance, and then we've had a range for 5 years. It has now broken and found support in the region of the previous peak and the 200-day moving average. And there's the clear potential that this represents a sea change in the viability of the sector. Biotechnology has been the seedbed for new treatments for the pharmaceutical sector for decades. Pharmaceutical companies have essentially outsourced their R&D to the biotech sector. In many respects, it's very similar to the kind of play that's used in private equity. Private equity investors spread their bets. They are fully aware that as many as 9 out of 10 will fail. But for the early stage investor, the one that goes up 10x will more than compensate them. And then they have the potential to get even more for it later. So that is very similar to how the biotech sector works. And what we are now seeing is the seedbed for new therapies to be developed over the course of the next few years. On the one hand, we have got the scope, at least, for genetic solutions to become more widely accepted, enabled by CRISPR-Cas9, and then subsequent iterations of that technology continues to accelerate as well. We're getting greater understanding of what's possible. There is also the potential for synthetic biology, which is the medical equivalent of computer programming. When we then think about the integration of all these in tandem with 3D printing of cells, then the clear scope is for the Human Genome Project 2.0 to develop a human genome from scratch and basically using artificial intelligence to write the code for several billion base pairs is very well in or close to completion. These are extremely important technological innovations, and then we also have the clear supportive environment from the stock market as well. So that is, I think, one of the biggest beneficiaries here. Now, when we think about the vaccine, well, there's been a lot of interest in biotech as a result of the vaccine development and the quantity of money that's getting thrown at the problem. It's quite likely that the first of the results will come through in October, more in November, more in December, and that we're going to have vaccines rolled out. One of the most important characteristics for approving a vaccine is a 50% effectiveness rate. Well, China already has a vaccine in the market with a 50% effectiveness rate. They're looking to try and develop vaccines in the West that are better than 50%, but that's not really the point. The point is that if people who have been deeply psychologically affected by the fear of death and the clear almost hysteria that has crept into the daily life of many people, if that can be allayed by getting a shot that is at least safe, then that will help to ameliorate some of the more negative economic consequences. Well, this week we bought our first flight tickets because I've come to the conclusion that we are no longer dealing with a substantial challenge, really, that the most basic defense against any form of infection, but particularly a coronavirus like the cold or indeed a flu, and the flu, of course, is not a coronavirus, but it's to boost one's own immune system. And that means getting plenty of exercise, consuming plenty of fruit and veg, and then generally having a more positive outlook on life. And the way, just the pursuit of happiness alone is something that can lend a great deal to one's own personal well-being as well as resistance to infections. So I think those are perhaps the biggest contributors to independence and also to immunity, and indeed to the ability to survive infection later. And then when I look at the toll that being at home is taking on my children, and I look at just the very difficult social and emotional impact that that is having, well, we've been organizing play dates for them. My eldest has been walking to the boba tea shop with her friends, and they are outside all of the time, which I think is very good. I'm really not worried about them catching it from one another. My other daughter is going on play dates as well, and they're hanging out in the gardens. They're not going inside the homes, but so far everything is going absolutely fine. And I say all of this because I really do think that I was proactive in warning people about what the dangers were, and I was very clear in telling people exactly what I was doing to lay up and to quarantine ourselves and what kind of supplies we were taking on board. And I think I really am duty-bound to share what I'm doing now, because I think that the danger has passed. When we think about the investment scenario, well, one of the biggest challenges is that the coronavirus is an accelerant. So it has taken trends that were clearly outstanding, and it's made them either better or worse. Well, the clear beneficiaries are, for example, the cloud computing sector. And that is very similar to what happened with Y2K back in the late 1990s. The evolution of software as a service, and then the outsourcing of databases to the cloud, or basically to data warehousing companies, has streamlined a lot of the back office for a significant portion of the corporate sector. It has created a wonderful business opportunity for the providers of these warehousing services, and then additionally for the service providers sitting on top of those warehouses. And that has represented a very significant rebound and almost a doubling from where we saw the lows in March. But of course, the other point is that it's been going on now for a really quite prolonged time. When we originally saw the breakout from base formations for example, Citrix Systems was one of the original companies that was pioneering cloud computing. And that was a share that really did not much at all between the peak in 2000 and about 2010. And then it completed its base formation. And then it went sideways for a really prolonged period. And then the cloud computing sector really took off in about 2015. So these are the kinds of shares that led on the upside. Now, they have been overtaken subsequently by new companies that have particularly levered the access to 4G and wireless technology. So that has been something that has detracted from the ability of the legacy companies to outperform. But they were the companies that led on the upside with cloud computing. So this trend of remote work and the ability to be productive anywhere has been underway for more than a decade already. But this has been a clear accelerant for it. So now the question for investors is whether the valuations that are currently existing are representative of what's potentially possible in future, or whether this growth rate that has picked up significantly in 2020 is going to be repeated later. And I think the repeated later is probably a bit too much to hope for, because we've already seen that there has been a massive surge in sales. And when you've invested in technology this year, do you really then need to do the whole thing again next year? It's quite unlikely. Of course, the subscription business model applies to a substantial number of these companies. So if they can, rather than thinking more about the infrastructure companies, but rather about the service providers, then they will benefit more from having more customers because the subscription business model smooths out the lumpiness of the infrastructure. I guess really the technology sector historically has been highly cyclical. If this were still a highly cyclical market, then this would be a very significant change that we've pulled forward so many sales. But if the majority of the companies are focused on the software as a service model and the subscription business model, then they should be able to hold on to more of those customers and eventually start to begin to charge more money. Then, when we look at the other side of the equation, well, the other big trend that we had that a lot of people were talking about in 2019 was the fact that a significant number of companies had been using every available dollar and to buy back shares. And the clear logic was that as long as companies were buying back their shares, then that would represent a clear and sustained tailwind for investors. So the Buyback Achievers ETF was among the best performing ETFs all the way through until about 2018. And then it went through a period of quite acute volatility. And now it's back below the trend mean. Now it was in positive territory in here today. But the problem for the constituents of this particular ETF is that it is likely to contract. The number of holdings currently is at 243. But the calculation of how this ETF is comprised is to take the rolling figure of buybacks on over a 12-month period. So it really means that as we head towards March, the number of constituents in the index will contract significantly because a lot of companies have already stopped buying back their shares, and that this is going to be reflected progressively more in this particular ETF. The reality is that a significant number of companies will no longer be in a position to continue to buy back such prestigiously large quantities of their shares. The most common catchphrase being used today in corporate conference calls is resilience. Well, resilience is pretty simple. Companies are going to start holding more cash, and they need that cushion. Of course, when we think about the airline sector, there has been significant funds made available to rescue a large number of airlines. They've also used this as an opportunity to fire large numbers of people, and that in one fell swoop has pretty much solved some of their pension problems because a large number of those airlines have had very old workforces who have built up significant pensions. Getting them to take redundancy or firing them outright, then at least it pushes them into the retired pool rather than keeping them inside the working workforce. So that at least is a potential benefit. The entire industrial sector has been under severe stress because with the collapse in the velocity of money, then people are not working and companies are still in an impaired situation. Even as companies do get back to work, they are being impaired by the social distancing guidelines. So that's obviously a challenge. But we are seeing value starting to be created. And Rolls-Royce, I think, is a rather interesting example because the acceleration on the downside has been acute. In just the last 6 weeks, the share has just about halved. And when we look at it over on the log scale, over the course of the last couple of years, the share has gone from 1,000 to 150. So 85% on the downside is, in many cases, enough. And we have got a very clear acceleration. So I bought some today because I do think that we're going to have some form of recovery in the industrial sector. I do think that there is going to be a vaccine. I don't really think it matters whether it works or not, but it's going to give politicians the ability to close out the lockdowns and then get way more active in terms of the reflation trade. Because when we start to think about what's the potential outcome from all of this, well, we know now that we're going to have low interest rates for the lengthy medium term. When, for example, we look at the 10-year treasury in the USA, well, it's been contained in a very inert fashion for most of the last month. But it certainly isn't rising in here, and it was in negative territory in here today. The bond market is already behaving as if we have got yield curve control in place. And it is simply logical that we're going to have a much more formal version of yield curve control introduced. We're in a situation today where unemployment is above where it was during the financial crisis 12 years ago. And that alone necessitated that interest rates stay low for a lengthy period of time, and that successive rounds of liquidity needed to be provided in order to stimulate economic activity. And we are currently in a period where governments are less inclined to provide liquidity. But it's inevitable they're going to have to do more. So then that is going to push out GDP, debt to GDP ratios. It's going to start to raise questions about the sustainability of debt. You have central banks that are clearly stating they believe that the primary way of stimulating will be through fiscal stimulus, and that they stand ready to buy whatever bonds are issued to fund that stimulus. Well, this is effectively modern monetary theory. And the way that you can ensure that modern monetary theory doesn't create a revolt in the bond markets is simple. You can simply fix the yields. So these are, I think, quite clearly potential outcomes that we're going to see within the next 12 months, because we are going to have to see additional stimulative measures. And the impact to consumer confidence has been material. It has greatly accelerated the speed with which the retail apocalypse is occurring. Well, we also have to bear in mind that acceleration is a trend ending, and it forces people to make decisions quickly. Well, that has represented a major uptick in the bankruptcies of retail organizations and the closing of a large number of stores. But what it also means is that the companies that can survive this crisis are going to come out the other end in a stronger position. They're going to have more of the market to or they're going to have captured more market share. So they will also benefit. So then when we think about the outlook for shares like TJX, well, it pulled back extremely violently during the lockdowns. But it then rebounded really quite impressively, coming from 35 all the way back up to 60. Well, this is a type 2 top with right-hand extension. And the big question here is whether it can sustain that sequence of higher reaction lows. So we are at a rather interesting juncture because these types of companies, Ross Stores and TJX, they prospered really beyond recognition following 2008 because people had less money. So they were willing to spend the time to go through row after row of clothing to find the one that represented a bargain. And that footfall in those stores was really very impressive. So obviously it was hanging out to short when the coronavirus started because of the lockdowns. They depend almost entirely on footfall. They don't do online retail. Well, now they are betting that people are going to start shopping again. And certainly from going to some of these stores and walking around and looking at their parking lots, people are looking a bit furtive as they go around, but there are certainly people in their stores. Well, what that just simply now suggests is they have had a pullback in the order of 20%, and now the big question is, what's it going to take to get people to go back out and start shopping again? Because certainly something that has occurred is that the cash position of a lot of people has improved, and they're spending less overall because of the fear, but also because they can't leave the house. Eventually, then, we're going to see a significant change. We're going to start to see people become more active. And that, I think, is going to hinge on the provision of the vaccine. Now, when we then start to think about how is that going to impact other asset classes, there's a clear likelihood that in just the same way that we had big pullbacks in 2000 and in 2008, that there's a big reflation trade afterwards. There is the clear potential that inflationary pressures will begin to rise next year. And in fact, that is central bank policy. That's what they want. That's what they're trying to engineer. And on a year-over-year basis, they're quite likely to achieve it because the quantity of money that is still ready to be printed is really very significant. And there's going to be a lot of it plowed into infrastructure projects. Well, oil prices are still under pressure and are locked now between this in this very tight range between $40 and $43, but a sustained move above the trend mean will really be required to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. We've also seen some meaningful moves in the agricultural commodities. Soybeans popped on the upside, but hasn't quite been able to hold all of the advance, and we're certainly now getting some consolidation. But the bigger picture here is that we had a substantial breakout in 2007, and subsequently prices have held the upper side of the underlying trading range. The defining characteristic of a bull market in commodities is a jump in the marginal cost of production. So then, if we go back and look at oil, well, on an historic basis, then oil prices have rebounded from that incredible condition around $20, but by and large have bounced around $40 for most of the last 12 years. And that's the upper side of the underlying trading range. And that's really quite similar to the kind of environment that happened before that. We'd had a lengthy range between 1974 and 1979 around the $10 level, and subsequently $10 became a new floor. So it's quite likely that $40 is probably where the floor is likely to be in oil prices for the foreseeable future. But it's going to take a material change in both demand and supply dynamics to see prices move anywhere close to $80. But that 100% range is likely to be a significant, I think, and lengthy range for the foreseeable future. We've also started to see that industrial resources are doing better. and copper prices continue to pause here around the $3 area, but they are substantially above the upper side of the base formation, and copper is likely to be among the big beneficiaries of an inflationary cycle, and infrastructure-led inflationary cycle is probably the clearest trend for next year. Well, then I think a lot of people are questioning what's next with gold. The price is still trading below $1,900. It has not been able to rebound back above it this week. We had a clear acceleration of the trend in the period up to the test of the psychological 2000 level, and now it's unwinding some of that advance. We could yet see it pull back to the region of the trend mean. That wouldn't be all that surprising. There have been plenty of occasions where we get an acceleration, we subsequently get a range, and then it unwinds the last portion of the overextension in just a couple of weeks, and then rebounds. The reality is that gold has done spectacularly well because of the clear trend of the devaluation of currencies. Well, one of the challenges right now is that the dollar is rallying, and it has now clearly broken the short-term downtrend. So it has been positive now just about every day this week, and it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. And that holds out the prospect that we could get an additional rally back up towards the region of the trend mean. The reason that the dollar had been weak all the way through March to the beginning of September was simple enough. The USA provided about half of all the liquidity to the global markets. So with that massive printing of dollars, it increased supply and the value decreased. The reason that it's rallying right now is that other countries are more willing to increase the size of their balance sheets, or their central bank's balance sheets, and that is increasing the supply of those currencies, whereas the US government or Congress has not really yet been able to agree on a new fiscal stimulus. So, and then you have the Federal Reserve, which has said that they're going to buy $120 billion worth of treasuries and mortgages a month. They said that in May, and they haven't bought any. So we're beginning to see that all of the promises that the Federal Reserve has made, they have expertly been able to jawbone the market higher, without in fact having to commit a large quantity of funds, by being extremely aggressive and supporting the repo market in 2019 with $450 billion, then that convinced investors that the Fed would do whatever it takes. And as a result of being able to convince investors of that fact, they haven't had to do it. So when we look at the quantity of money that they said that they would introduce and how much they have actually done, there is a huge disparity. And of course, that restricts the quantity of dollars in circulation. So then we have got these two factors. So the dollar's supply is not increasing as rapidly as people had anticipated, and the supply of other currencies is increasing faster than others had anticipated. So therefore, it's likely that the dollar will continue to rally and that we will get at least a reversion back to the mean. Of course, when we then think about, well, what is the outlook for the dollar over the lengthy medium term? I think the most important point here is that it has broken this uptrend from 2018. And therefore, this area around the 96 level represents an area of potential resistance. So it could quite easily get there. That would also coincide with a reversion back to the mean for gold. But considering that the move has already been more than halfway completed already, then it could potentially encounter resistance at any point between here and there as well. But a clear change will be demonstrated by a clear downward dynamic and an upward dynamic for gold. When we then think about the long term, well, there are extraordinary debts that have been taken on, and this is not a new phenomenon. It's another trend that the coronavirus has accelerated, and we're getting to the point where the quantity of money being printed is accelerating. The interest rates that are being offered are completely inconsequential. Therefore, it has greatly increased the interest rate sensitivity of markets. So right now we're at a point where stock markets have firmed and they are beginning to steady in the region of the 200-day moving average. We're starting to see that people are coming around to the idea, at least, that recovery is possible. It looks like markets are much more willing to price in that eventuality than individual consumers are, but there's nothing particularly new about that. Eventually, we're going to have to deal with the question about how to fund the deficits. And inflation is the clear answer. That's basically what the Federal Reserve and other central banks are trying to achieve. Now, companies have the potential to increase dividends at a rate faster than inflation. So they generally tend to do reasonably well in the early portion of a new inflationary cycle. So that does suggest that we could have an inflationary boom in the early part of this new cycle. But as inflationary pressures become persistent, then you would potentially get an inflationary bust. But we're only at the beginning of this new cycle. We haven't even begun to see inflationary pressures rising. And what that suggests is that the bull market in gold has got a lot further to go. The bull market that we have in stocks is really only beginning to get started after this hiatus that we've had. And when we then think about what's going on in Europe, well, the Eurostoxx index has been under some pressure this week, and it's encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. Now, this really comes back to this question about how data is interpreted and the unreliability of data when you don't have control factors. Europe is introducing additional lockdowns. That's likely to take an economic toll. But I think people are eventually going to come around to the idea that this has been the wrong thing to do. And Europe has the potential to come out of this crisis in a better position, because it's likely to drive greater cohesion. In many respects, the outlook for inflation is going to rescue a lot of heavily indebted companies and countries. So when inflationary pressures begin to rise, then that is likely to be beneficial for Europe as well. But it's obviously on the understanding that we do get additional cohesion. The long-term potential bullish outcome for Europe is that they do create a United States of Europe. That's, I think, one of the most interesting contrarian ways of thinking about markets. I've perused Ray Dalio's latest chapter on the changing global order. And there are a couple of, I think, important points. It's very easy to simply frame this question as the competition between the USA and China, and China's status as a reserve currency internationally is still only at around 2%. So the growth trend is obviously supportive, but the euro is about 20%. And Europe has got a lot of headwinds. And some of them are demographic, some of them are military and financial, but perhaps the biggest I guess, challenge that Europe has to achieving reserve currency status is the fact that it's not a united country. Well, if Europe was united with a population of 450 billion people, then that's a very significant economic bloc. Then, when we start to think about energy, well, China announced this week that they want to be carbon neutral by 2050. Now, forget for the moment whether that is serious, considering the pace with which they're building new coal-fired power stations and the reliance of the country on coal for its electricity. And then think about the investments that Europe is making in renewable technology. Now, Elon Musk this week showcased a whole range of incremental new battery technologies that, on aggregate, could contribute to a decline of about 58% in the cost of producing batteries. Well, that could be transformative for Europe, and it would be a really profound effect on their energy independence if they can come through with a renewable energy solution that could, in fact, deplete the dependence on imported oil. Of course, the health of the European economy in being able to, in fact, try and compete internationally when there's less demand for internal combustion engines is another question that would need to be answered. But the important point is that Europe is cheap, and it has, in many respects, been left out of the technological innovation that has primed the US and Chinese economies. But it is, I think, a region to pay attention to, because if they do, in fact, start to address some of the internal problems, then it does have a lot of residual value that is sitting there that could be realized. So it's not exactly the place where you need to be rushing to buy today, but it isn't a place that should be completely discounted either, because in many respects it has been completely discounted by investors. And it is usually when people completely forget about a place against a background where they are making substantial changes, then that generally does create an investment opportunity over the medium to longer term, because the creation of fiscal cohesion and sovereign bond, excuse me, of federal bonds in Europe is a meaningful event that's happened this year. When we then think about Tesla, well, they're going to have to invest a great deal of money to retool. Now, the share was in positive territory in here today, and it has rebounded over the last 2 days. I still think that $500 is probably the upper side of the range, and that it is going to spend a good long period of time going sideways. But that would be in normal conditions. The other point, of course, about some of these high momentum shares is that they're lightning rods for speculative flows when there is the potential for additional stimulus. The one potential short-term surprise would be that the Republicans and Democrats in the USA could get together and agree a fiscal stimulus. The additional $600 unemployment benefit expired at the end of July. The additional $300 benefit introduced to replace that expires in the end of September. And a large number of the protections for workers that were introduced as part of the paycheck protection plans introduced 6 months ago expire on the 30th of September as well. So we do have the uncertainty about the US presidential election. I think that the risk of a failed election or a lengthy period where there is a long and a very clear debate about who won is a very likely scenario. But the reality is that unless we get an additional stimulative measure, then the economy can't really wait around for politicians to argue about who wins the election. And I think they understand that. So there's the potential, at least, that we could get additional stimulative measures that could take us through to the end of the year. And if we do get that, then that would set the market up for an additional pop on the upside. When we then think about what's going to happen in China, well, we continue to see this geopolitical tension rising. And the CSI 300 has been going sideways now for 3 months, and it is right on the lower side of its range. The problem for investors with investing in China is that you don't really know whether you've got the government at your back or not. And it's a just in terms of governance, you just don't have the clear ability to make decisions based upon regularity of actions. The Chinex index, which is heavily weighted by new companies, remains in a corrective phase and likely to continue to revert back down towards the mean. When we then think about the IPO sector in the USA, it continues to rebound and was at a new high as recently as the beginning of this month, and it's continuing to find support around the $50 area this week. So this is still a clear uptrend. So the clear message here is that we are still in a recovery scenario. We haven't had a great deal of additional liquidity provided in the last month, which has contributed to the weakness in stock markets. But the likelihood is potentially that we're going to have additional stimulative measures announced in the short term, and that should help to support markets. I am anticipating that we're going to have some volatility going into the presidential election. In fact, the stock market is about the best indicator of whether the incumbent is going to win or not. So, if we really want to get an idea about who's going to win the election, the stock market will probably tell us. If it rallies into the beginning of November, it's quite likely the incumbent will win. If the Trump administration is reinstated, then it is quite likely we're going to have additional stimulative measures. So, that is potentially what is being priced in at present. I do think that when we look at what is out there on the horizon, there is the clear scope for an inflationary boom followed by an inflationary bust, but perhaps not for years. And that in that time, we're likely to see a significant advance in, I think, a ro clear rotation, really, out of the success stories of 2020 and into reflation stories, clearly defined by industrials, resources, and the gold market. And gold is likely to continue to remain in a medium-term bull market, or potentially long-term bull market, because the clear intention of central banks is to devalue the purchasing power of currencies. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.